Also joining us, we have Dr. Tracy Stecker. She's an assistant professor at Dartmouth Medical School in the Department of Psychiatry and Health Science Specialist. Oh, I'm sorry, in Department of Psychiatry and Health Science Specialist at the White River Junction VA Medical Center. Joining her today is Bridget Matarazzo, and she is a clinical research psychologist at the Rocky Mountain Mental Illness Research Education and Clinical Center, known as MIREC, and that's in Denver VA Medical Center. She's also an assistant professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, also in the Department of Psychiatry. So I'd like to thank you both so much for joining us today and presenting. And Dr. Stecker, are you ready to share your screen?
I am.
Excellent. You should have that pop up now. And there we go.
What I'm going to do, I'm going to start the presentation today talking about an intervention, an ongoing trial that we're doing that assesses the effectiveness of a phone-based session to improve treatment seeking among suicidal veterans who have not accessed care. And then I'm going to hand it off to Dr. Matarazzo, who is going to talk about a therapy, a specifically tailored therapy to high-risk suicidal veterans who have been hospitalized. So I will start the session talking about some of the early results of the study to improve treatment seeking. The background on this is that the rates of PTSD and depression are moderately high among veterans returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The rate of suicidal ideation is between 6 and 12%, and 22 veterans die by suicide per day.
Thank you. So now we're going to go ahead and get to a poll question real quick. We would like to ask our audience their thoughts on this. I guess your best educated guess. What is the percentage of suicidal veterans who seek treatment? And your answer options are 5%, 25%, 50%, or 75%. So the poll question is up on your screen. Just click the circle next to your response. These are anonymous answers, and you're not being graded. So all the incentive in the world to answer. Okay, we've got a pretty responsive group. About 70% of our audience has voted so far, but responses are still streaming in, so we'll give people a few more seconds. Okay, it looks like we've capped off close to 80% response rate, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll now, and I'll share those results. So it looks like 25% think that 5% of suicidal veterans seek treatment. We have 68% who think that 1/4 of veterans seek treatment. 6% think that 1/2 of veterans seek treatment. And 1% think that 3/4 of veterans seek treatment. So thank you for those responses. And Dr. Stecker, I will turn it back to you.
So the truth is we probably don't have a good estimate of how many suicidal veterans seek treatment, mostly because the individuals are not necessarily in the healthcare system or reporting their symptoms. Although I agree with most of the responses that it's probably only about 25%, their best guess of suicidal veterans who seek healthcare, any healthcare, whether it's VA or non-VA care. So we still have about 75% of individuals who are struggling with symptoms and suicidality who are not reaching out for help. And again, just a little bit more on the background, 7% of the U.S. population are vets, but they account for about 20% of the suicides. And in 2013, the VA spent a lot of money treating some of the disorders associated with suicide, including PTSD. Here again is some information about the number of veterans who acknowledge mental health symptoms and then come in for treatment. Only about 1/4 to maybe 1/2. The trial that I'm going to talk about is a trial aimed to test the effectiveness of a cognitive behavioral intervention that's administered by phone that is designed to modify beliefs about treatment so that veterans who are at risk for suicide are more likely to seek treatment. In this trial, which is funded by the Department of Defense, we are recruiting 1,200 U.S. service members who served in the military since 9/11, who report suicidality on the PHQ-9 item number 9, and who are not receiving mental health services. We assess various symptoms, including PTSD through the PCL, depression through the PHQ-9. We assess beliefs about treatment using the PASS, the Perceptions About Services Scale. We assess substance use through the ASI, the Addiction Severity Index. We use the Columbia Scale, which assesses suicidality. We assess sleep through the Insomnia Severity Scale. We're assessing pain, and we assess on a 7-item scale symptoms of feeling a burden or belonging. The assessments are conducted at baseline, month 1, 3, 6, and 12 months. All participants that we are recruiting 1,200 participants, we're just started year 3 of this trial, and we've recruited over 650 participants already. Of the 1,200, they are randomly assigned to either receive the intervention or the control. Half of which will receive the intervention, half will be in the control condition. In the control condition, they do not have anything happen. It is just assessment purely. All participants complete the baseline assessment. The intervention participants receive an intervention session administered by phone at both baseline and at the 1-month follow-up. And again, follow-up or interviews are conducted at months 1, 3, 6, and 12. The phone-based intervention is based on cognitive behavioral principles, and during that session, participants are asked to discuss some of their beliefs about treatment about getting help, and the session is designed to modify or discuss some of those beliefs about treatment so that they're more likely to be open to seeking help. Because this is a trial on suicidality and because all of our participants are not currently receiving any services, it is important we have a safety protocol. We are affiliated with the VA's National Crisis Line. What we do with individuals who present at imminent risk for suicide is transfer the call to the crisis line so that they can immediately link in with somebody who is better equipped to get them immediate care. We will also stay with them during that call and talk with the local suicide prevention coordinator as well in order to facilitate the process of getting them support. Again, we are starting our third year in this 6-year trial. Excuse that year 1 at the top of this slide here. That is not accurate. At this time, in terms of the data that is entered into the system, we've had 286 participants who are in the intervention condition and 284 participants who are in the control condition. And this just shows mean age. They're both about 31 years old. The percentage that is male, so about 10% of each group is female, and the percentage that is Caucasian, so about 25% is other than Caucasian. In terms of branch, as we would expect, the majority of participants served in the Army or are serving in the Army. A third have been in the National Guard. Less than 10% in the Navy and Air Force, and about 15% of each in the Marines. In terms of baseline clinical characteristics, These scores are moderately severe symptoms of both PTSD and depression. They are at baseline reporting some symptoms that are interfering with their functioning. And again, they are also reporting quite a bit of substance use, including alcohol and marijuana. These are the two most frequently reported substances that are being used at baseline. About a third of our sample has reported that they've had previous attempts, and this is some data on what they have done during their attempts. We've had 211 overdoses, cutting, using guns, and hanging. And then I didn't list the 83 other because there were quite a few different methods used here. But obviously, as you can see on this, access to medicines is the most likely way people have had previous attempts. I'm also going to go through a sample intervention session and just discuss what a session might look like for individuals who are interested. This is a session that was conducted on an individual named Harry. He was a 29-year-old black male who had been in the Navy, and he had deployed to Iraq. At baseline, he was reporting quite a few symptoms, particularly with respect to PTSD and depression. His PHQ-9 score is high. He described himself as the Walking Dead. His quote, "The military trained me to die on the one hand, but they also trained me to be disciplined." He did not have a job and was not functioning well enough to be employed. Also was not seeking services. He had a lot of hopelessness and helplessness. He felt things did not go his way when he tried to seek help. He reported a couple different plans for suicide and the intention to act on these plans immediately. He was intending to use pills and alcohol to die, and believed that his 4-year-old daughter would be better off without him. In terms of his thoughts about treatment, he did not wish to seek help because he didn't want to be labeled as crazy. And he had a lot of ambivalence about continuing to suffer. He reported that every day was hard to be alive, and he wasn't sure that he had the energy to engage in what it would take to seek help or to get better. A lot of ambivalence about being here. During the discussion about his thoughts about treatment, he reported that he believed his little girl would be better off without him, he also reported that for her it was worth it to try. However, his depression was so severe and dark that it was difficult for him to have any hope about things getting better. Upon further challenging on the thought that his daughter would be better off without him, he became very agitated, not only wanted to leave the session, but wanted to not be alive anymore. And because of the imminent risk to his safety, we did activate the safety protocol and had the crisis line and his local suicide prevention coordinator in touch with him. That day, he was brought into the VA to discuss available services to him, and actually, even though he went to the VA and talked to the crisis line and met with the suicide prevention coordinator, he did not agree to services that day. In fact, it was quite a while before he got in for any help at all, but this was somebody who went to our safety protocol, and we got him linked in with providers immediately because of the extent of his thoughts. In summary, I'm going to pass it off to Dr. Matarazzo now. There are many veterans out there who are suffering extensively, and while they suffer and are in enormous pain, there are beliefs about treatment that interfere with their ability to seek help. Talking through these beliefs may help veterans seek help earlier. I know I presented a case in which talking through the decision wasn't necessarily the thing that helped, and his depression was so severe, but the majority of individuals are at a point where they are able to have the conversation to talk through the beliefs about treatment.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stecker. And Dr. Matarazzo, you should have that pop up now to share your screen.
I clicked on it. I think it's just loading.
And there we go. Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much. So today I'm going to be talking to you about the Home-Based Mental Health Evaluation Program, or HOME program as we call it. And similar to what Dr. Stecker presented, one component of this program is talking to veterans about their beliefs about care. And there's other components which I'll get into, but it has a similar aim in terms of engaging folks in care. So my normal VA disclaimer, and also wanted to mention that this project is funded by the VA Mental Health Services. The program has expanded over time, which I'll talk about at the end of my talk today, but this component that I'll be presenting data from today was funded by VA Mental Health Services. So if we want to go ahead with the first poll question.
Thank you. So for our attendees, you'd see up on your screen now the poll question for what is your primary role in VA? And we know that you may wear many hats within the VA, but we'd like you to choose your primary role, so please select just one. The answer options are student, trainee, or fellow, clinician, researcher, manager, or policymaker, or other. And for those of you selecting other, please note that at the end of our session, during our feedback survey, there will be a more extensive list of positions here at the VA, so you might find your exact job title there, so please stay tuned. And it looks like 81% of our audience has voted, so at this time I'd like to close that out and share those results. So as you can see, just over half of our audience are clinicians, about one-fifth are researchers, 16% report other, 7% manager or policymaker, and 4% are student, trainees, or fellows. So thank you to those respondents, and I will turn it back to you now.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. That's helpful for me to hear just there's sort of different aspects of this program that I can speak more to. And since the majority of folks are clinicians, I'll make sure I give you some good information about the intervention itself. And before I get into that, though, I want to talk just about the sort of background literature about suicide risk following psychiatric hospitalization. So this slide sort of illustrates this continuum of risk that we think about, or this trajectory of risk. So it's been found in both veteran and military samples that the post-hospitalization suicide rate is about 5 times greater than that of the reported base rate. So we know this risk, this time period following hospitalization is a period of elevated risk. And it looks like it's about 12 weeks or so post-hospitalization tends to be the highest risk, with the first week post-hospitalization being the highest risk period of time. And that's been found in both veteran and civilian samples. And then some research done in the civilian sector found that about half of folks who died by suicide following hospital discharge did so prior to the date of their first follow-up appointment. So even if folks did have care established for when they left the hospital, many of them are dying before they make it to that first appointment. So we know that this time period, again, immediately hospitalization, is really a critical time for intervention and follow-up to make sure folks are doing okay. And then thinking about lack of treatment engagement, this has been talked about in both military and veteran literature as a huge barrier to suicide prevention efforts. And we know that some work out of with Desai and colleagues found that in a sample of veterans, poor continuity of care post-hospitalization was found to be associated with death by suicide. So we know that just being post-hospitalization puts folks at elevated risk for suicide, and then if they're not engaging in care, that further elevates their risk. And so being aware of these factors, we were really interested in some work that came out of the Netherlands by Verwey and colleagues. And what they did was talk to folks while they were in the hospital immediately following a suicide attempt, and then went and visited them in their home environment and assessed them again once they were back home. And they found some interesting things. So they found that once patients were back home, they were actually reporting lower self-esteem and higher worry than they were in the hospital following the attempt. So they had these sort of added risk factors once they were back home. 35% of them didn't remember their discharge plans. So certainly one reason why folks might not be engaging in care post-discharge is that they don't even remember their plans. And this was despite them being given to them both verbally and in writing. So as many of you know, VA has done a lot to require that there's appointments being made within that first week post-discharge. But, you know, we do what we can on our end, and then it's up to our patients to remember those plans and to show up. So a fair number of folks, and again, this is a different sample, but might speak to sort of this phenomenon that happens where folks forget their discharge plans. And a large number of them, 86%, who said while they were in the hospital, they said, you know, I'm not interested in post-discharge care. I don't think I'll need it. They changed their minds when they got back home. So, again, we think something is happening when folks get back home that they realize maybe they're not doing so well once they're back in their environment, and they do need some additional support. So Verwey and colleagues suggested that reassessment once folks are back home may enhance the accuracy of assessments, so figuring out how exactly they feel once they're back home, improve treatment planning, and encourage follow-up care. So a lot of this literature spurred the development of the home program. And so I'll walk you through sort of what the components of the program are. So importantly, we meet the veteran while they're still on the inpatient unit. We think this does a lot to build rapport and really give the veteran a sense of continuity of care throughout our system. So folks can feel quite disjointed. They get close to their inpatient team, and perhaps they haven't even met their outpatient team providers. And so we really kind of provide a bridge and a familiar face of somebody they can be talking to through that transition. So first meet them on the unit, and then we have telephone follow-up with them the first day that they're back home from the hospital. And during that phone call, we do a very thorough suicide risk assessment. We review and update their safety plan. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with the VA safety plan. If they were not discharged with a safety plan, then we actually complete one during that phone call. If they already have one, then we take the time to review the safety plan, make sure they're familiar with it, have a copy of it, and also ask them what they want to change on their safety plan. So, you know, you developed this great plan while you were on the inpatient unit. Now that you're home, what has changed? Have you noticed any new warning signs now that you're back in that environment, or some of the resources that were available to you for coping? Have they changed now that you're home? That sort of a thing. And then the final component is that we really address these barriers to care. So similar to what Dr. Stecker was talking about earlier, folks may have a variety of cognitions related to engaging in care that could be related to stigma. Some folks, it's purely logistical. They don't know how to get to the VA. Other folks, they have misconceptions about why they might need mental health treatment. And so our clinicians do a lot to address those barriers. And then just to remind them of their appointments, because oftentimes folks are confused about their care or just forget what those appointments are. And then during the first week post-discharge, we go and visit them in their home. And by home, we have a pretty loose definition of home. As many of you know, our population can have a variety of places that they're going to, that they're calling home after hospitalization. So we go to grand per diem sites, we go to shelters, we go to independent living situations, whether that's in the veteran's own home or if they're staying with family and friends. As long as it's a safe environment for our clinician to be in, we will go there. So we go to that home environment, and we do all of the same things that we did over the phone during that first phone call. But in addition to that, we meet with any support system that's in the home environment, whether that's family, friends, whoever's sort of supporting the veteran. We meet with them as much as they want the veteran to be involved in that visit. That can really help us do things like beef up safety planning in terms of identifying warning signs and also coming up with coping strategies. And then we also can do a lot of creative things around means safety when we're in the home. That is a lot harder to do in the office or over the phone. So, for example, we've had multiple cases where, you know, a veteran had a plan to make his environment more safe by either removing firearms or removing ropes from their vehicle, certain things, and we can follow up on that when we're actually in the home, and if they haven't done it yet, we can encourage them to do it during the visit. So we've had some nice outcomes in that way. And then following that home visit, we do at least weekly follow-up with the veteran over the phone until they're engaged in care. Okay, so what I'm going to move on to now is talking about some evaluation of this project that we did. So this was funded as a clinical demonstration project here at the Denver VA, and we looked at, our primary aim was treatment engagement. So does it look like home is helping folks engage in care? So our first hypothesis was that the folks in home would be significantly more likely to engage in care as compared to a matched archival control group. And our second hypothesis was that they would engage in care in a significantly shorter period of time, so more likely to engage and engage more quickly. And our secondary aim was really just to collect data on participants' post-discharge symptoms. So we wanted to see if for this population of veterans that were receiving the home intervention, if they sort of had the symptom kind of constellation that you would expect given the literature post-discharge. So our third hypothesis was that with respect to mood-related symptoms and suicidal ideation, folks that were in home would be doing a little bit worse when they got out of the hospital during that first week as compared to when they were on the inpatient unit. And as I talked about before, the literature really suggests that folks do worse right when they get home. So that's what we hypothesized. And then our final hypothesis was that when we compared how folks were doing during that first week to how they were doing 3 months later, we thought that they would be doing better, so they would have a decrease in symptoms. So I'll get into the methods of how we looked at this. So the participants were a total of 68 veterans that were admitted to the inpatient psychiatric unit, and they endorsed suicidal ideation and or behavior at the time of admission. Half of that group, so 34, were in the intervention group. They received the home program as a clinical demonstration project. And then the other 34 were a gender and age-matched archival control group. So in terms of data collection, to address our primary aim of treatment engagement, we used the medical record. So we looked at all mental health and substance abuse appointments 90 days post-discharge to look at treatment engagement. And in terms of gathering data for the participant characteristics, and this was just an N of 34, so this was just the folks who participated in the intervention, we collected data at four different time points. So baseline while they're on the unit, 1 week, roughly about 1 week post-discharge, and then prior to the home visit, which was about that first week, and then 1 week post-enrollment, disenrollment, so after they engaged in care, how are they doing, and then also 3 months post-discharge. Okay, so I will now talk about some of the results. So with respect to treatment engagement, 100% of the folks who participated in the home program did engage in care at 90 days post-discharge, whereas 79% of the folks in the control group had engaged in care in the same amount of time. And this was a significant association between home participation and treatment engagement. So, like I spoke about, we wanted to identify if folks were more likely to engage in care, which it looks like they were, and then we also wanted to see if they engaged in care more quickly. So as I mentioned before, this time period is very, very critical post-hospitalization and that first week looking particularly dangerous. And so when we looked at median days till treatment engagement, there was a significant difference in time to treatment engagement, with the home participants engaging in care in a significantly shorter amount of time. And we also ran some additional analyses to look at how many appointments veterans attended. So once they're engaged in care, are the folks who participated in home attending more appointments? And it looks like that with respect to individual mental health appointments, and when we combine individual mental health and substance abuse appointments, those who participated in home are attending more appointments than those in the control group. So they're more likely to engage in a shorter period of time and attending more individual appointments. So now moving into more of the participant characteristics. So again, this is just the 34 folks who did engage in the home program. They are characterized by a lot of factors that we consider to be placing folks at elevated risk for suicide. And so such as being male, white race, not married or partnered, and unemployed, and a fair amount of homelessness in this population as well. So certainly marked by a lot of risk factors, the most significant of which is suicidal behavior. So close to 70% of the population did have a history of suicidal behavior, which is placing that at certainly elevated risk. So we know that the folks who were getting into this program is sort of the population of interest. It's who we want to be helping from a suicide prevention standpoint. So when we look at our third hypothesis, this was when we hypothesized that folks would be doing worse after they left the hospital as compared to before, we found that folks were actually doing significantly better. So the top part of this slide is for the brief symptom inventory, so sort of general mood symptoms, and then the Beck scale for suicidal ideation. So they actually were significantly improved post-discharge, which was contrary to our hypothesis. And it sort of begs the question of whether or not home is making a difference for folks. So if you would fully expect that folks do worse when they leave the hospital and our folks were doing a lot better, certainly something's happening there. And we don't know if that has anything to do with home yet, but I'll talk about a trial that we have now ongoing where we hope to be able to answer that question. So we also hypothesized that folks would be doing significantly better 3 months post-discharge as compared to the first week post-discharge. Those differences were not significant. And perhaps that's because the participants were doing a lot better during that first week than we thought they would be. But when that was not significant, we also looked at looking at folks at time one versus time four, so baseline while they were on the unit, and then looking at 3 months better. And it looks like with respect to overall mood symptoms, they were doing better, but there were no significant findings with respect to suicidal ideation. One other measure that we included that I wanted to share the results on is from the attitudes towards seeking professional psychological help scale. And this is really geared at asking folks about their beliefs, their attitudes towards seeking help. And when we look at the comparison of time one and time four, there is a significant difference. So folks are tending at 3 months post-discharge, tending to have a better attitude about seeking care than they are while they're in the hospital. Okay, so now I'll move to a discussion of these results. So to summarize, in the first 90 days post-hospitalization, veterans who participated in the home program as compared to archival matched controls were more likely to engage in care. They were more likely to engage in care in a shorter amount of time and to attend more individual outpatient appointments. We also know from these data that veterans in the home program are characterized by many factors that place them at increased risk for suicide, and they are experiencing decreased ideation and other symptoms once they get home from the hospital, which, as I noted before, is discrepant from what we would expect from the literature. And their attitude towards seeking mental health care is improving at 90-day follow-up. So there are certainly many limitations of this. We were just evaluating a clinical demonstration project, so it was a pretty small sample, and we had no comparison group for the prospective data. So we're not really sure what our findings mean with respect to the ideation and mood symptoms. So in terms of how home has and is continuing to expand over time, can speak a little bit to how we're currently conducting a trial that addresses some of the limitations of the results I just presented. So as you can see here, the Mental Health Services funded the clinical demonstration project here in Denver starting in 2012, and then it expanded to Salt Lake City the following year. And that provided us, that demonstration project data provided us with some nice pilot data to submit a grant to the Military Suicide Research Consortium, who then funded a multi-site clinical trial of the HOME program that we currently have going on at the Denver, Houston, Portland, and Philadelphia VAs. And so we have two active sites and two control sites for that trial. And so that's letting us look at this in a much more effective way. And we look forward to those results after we wrap up that trial about a year from now. And then Mental Health Services has continued to fund the clinical demonstration project in Durham, North Carolina. And we've also received funding from the Office of Rural Health to be expanding the intervention to rural veterans. So with that, we're looking at veterans who are hospitalized in more of a metro area, Durham, but then they're going back to their homes, which are in a rural environment, and seeing how home is helpful with rural veterans. So while we're sort of collecting the data from the clinical trial, we're really able to test out different ways of implementing this across the VA system, both with rural and non-rural veterans. Okay, so now we can open it up for questions and comments, and my contact information and Dr. Steckers is on this final slide.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We do have some great pending questions already. For those of you that joined us after the top of the hour, to submit your question or comment, please use the GoToWebinar dashboard on the right-hand side of your screen. Just click the plus sign next to the word questions, and that will expand the dialog box, and you can then submit it, and we'll get to it in the order that it is received. The first question came in, are the inpatient staff making the calls within the 1 day of discharge and going home visit also? And I'm sorry, let me start that over. Are the inpatient staff making the calls within the 1 day of discharge and going to home visit site also, or is it other staff?
That's a great question. So it's actually a provider who is specific to the home program who's doing this. So it's not a inpatient staff team member or an outpatient team staff member. There's somebody who is specifically hired to do this position of being on the home team.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And this first, go ahead.
Sorry, just to clarify, they're doing both of those things. So they're the one who meets the veteran on the unit and follows them all the way through till they're engaged in care. It's the same home provider.
Thank you. This question came in during Dr. Stecker's portion. I apologize if you covered this. I missed the beginning of the presentation. You spoke about veterans calling the helpline. I assume that's an anonymous call, and if so, when they present an imminent danger to themselves or others, is there any recourse that the attending call taker can make to ensure their safety?
My understanding, I don't work at the crisis line, so I'm speaking on their behalf, so I can double check this information, but my understanding of the technology at the crisis line is that they are able to trace calls. So even if somebody calls in and is not identifying themselves, the responder is able to identify the phone that they're calling from and get some information about where that individual is located.
Thank you. The next question, who all is on the home team?
Sure. So there's, at this point, to sort of at the three different, well, with the trial, four different VAs that we've tried this at, it's just taken one FTE. We started the program with a psychologist being the home provider and have since moved it to master's level clinicians. And so the data that I presented was with a psychologist, and then all the kind of home clinicians we've had since that time have been master's level clinicians. So I provide oversight and training, but there's really one provider at each VA that we've done this at so far.
Thank you. This is a very small sample size for home. How much effort / resources would be needed to expand this program to all who need it?
That's a great question. So we actually, in the time that we ran the clinical demonstration project here, we had over 100 veterans participate in it. These were the 34 that enrolled in the research arm of it. So we've presented it as a clinical demonstration project, which far more veterans enrolled in than those that agreed to do the research study. So with the one FTE that we've had so far, that's been enough staffing to support the need at each hospital. I would like to eventually be able to expand the program, if possible, to include community hospitals that our veterans are seen at. I think those veterans are at certainly elevated risk. That would require more FTE, but at this point, one FTE per hospital has been working for us at the sites we've done this so far.
Along those same lines, will there be more studies because the N is very minimal?
Yes, the clinical trial that we have going so far, we have another year of recruitment ahead of us, but so far we have 200 folks in it. So 100 folks who have received the intervention and 100 who have not. So that will certainly be a much higher N for the trial.
Thank you. The characteristics of the sample indicate that the populations are predominantly Caucasian males. What is being done to address female veterans at suicide risk or those who identify other than Caucasian?
That's a great question. So we do, we do offer the intervention to anybody who is eligible on our inpatient unit. And the fact that the population is predominantly male and Caucasian is kind of a byproduct of who is on our inpatient unit. We have done some strategizing here about how to make the program more comfortable for women, in particular, if they're feeling uncomfortable about a provider being in their home, that sort of thing. So we're trying to be very culturally sensitive to those sorts of factors. But I think that discrepancy you're seeing is mostly just a byproduct of who our population is, rather than folks who are agreeing to do the program.
Thank you. Can both of you talk more about the threshold for initiating the suicide safety protocols? Is this type of research? Oh, I'm sorry. We'll start with just that. So can both of you talk more about the threshold for initiating the suicide safety protocols? And we'll get to the other portions in a minute.
Sure. I can go first if you want, Tracy. With our study, since we're dealing with working with folks that are at such elevated risk, we really think about it being with respect to their baseline in terms of what that threshold is. So because our work really is involving thorough suicide risk assessment of these folks, we get a sense of what their baseline is, which is pretty high. But if folks are, we really think about imminent risk when we think about intervening and initiating any sort of safety protocol. So if they are intending on doing something that day, for example, we've called welfare checks before or have worked with folks to get them safely to the VA or to another hospital. So it's really about what they're intending on doing that day in terms of, or in the near future, in terms of their own safety.
I agree. I actually have the same answer, although I really like the question, and it was something that my team and I consulted experts on. Probably during the course of an entire year, we repeatedly went back to that question, who is at risk? When do we initiate the safety protocol? And I think that over time, it became slightly more clear, although it is a difficult thing to answer. But to summarize, I think I would have to agree with what Dr. Matarazzo said, which is essentially that it's an individual who has reported that they have a plan, that they are going to act on that plan, and they are going to act on that plan immediately. And then within that, somewhat surprisingly, there is a lot of variability there. You definitely can have an individual who can talk about a plan that they would like to act on, and having access to that plan and the desire to act on that plan at some point, but not necessarily that day. It becomes in a way learning to trust your gut with that data when somebody means it. There is also all sorts of tone that is taken into account, and some of the other symptoms and information that they're reporting. But it does come down to the bottom line of, are they going to do it right away? Are they going to do it within the next 24 hours? And if they say that they are going to do that, then that's when we would initiate immediate assistance.
Thank you both for those replies. There is a couple more portions to that question. In this type of research, subjects are at elevated risk at baseline, so figuring out the threshold is hard. In addition, for Dr. Stecker's study, one wonders whether involving the Veterans Crisis Line then becomes an intervention itself and thus contaminating the unique effect of the intervention. How did you deal with this?
Well, what we hope is that the people who end up in the, have to go through the suicide safety protocol, that it's randomized evenly between the intervention and control participants. It is something we do not only do for intervention participants, it's something we do for all of our participants at any point when it comes up. If they need to be put on safety protocol, then we will do that. Likely with an N of 1200 that will be random between both intervention and control participants. It does change outcomes, though, in terms of it is no longer a test of whether or not the intervention in and of itself is helpful at getting an individual into treatment. If we have this other option of basically mandating immediate care among individuals at high risk of suicide. But again, hopefully that will be evenly distributed between the two groups, but it will be something that we track.
Thank you. Are either of you following the veterans when they live more than 40 miles from a VA hospital?
I definitely am. Our population is nationwide, and so there's lots of variability there with respect to how far away they are from a VA, and we are collecting that data.
Our home, there's, depending on the arm of home that we're talking about, there's a little bit of variability, but for the most part, we're following folks that live about to 45 minutes to an hour or so from the medical center. And then in the rural arm that we're doing in North Carolina, folks are, if I remember correctly, up to 2 hours away.
Thank you both. The next question, how is the HOME program different than the ACT team, the Assertive Community Treatment Team?
It's a good question that I don't have a good answer to. I have some familiarity with the ACT teams, but not a ton. But one thing that I have noticed thus far is just our very intense focus on suicide risk assessment, safety planning, and treatment engagement. So my understanding is that the ACT teams, and I certainly might be wrong, but my understanding is that the ACT teams are focused on, you know, more general kind of mental health and case management sort of needs. And we're really specifically attending to their suicide risk and treatment engagement. And it's really just a bridge service also. I think folks are aligned with ACT teams for longer, and it's also not specific to post-discharge time period. So we're really just kind of bridging that gap between inpatient and outpatient care. So I apologize if that's not an accurate understanding of the ACT teams, but that's my understanding of how it's different.
Thank you. Our facility does not have an inpatient psychiatric unit. We send our veterans 7 hours to another VA facility. Do you see this program could work in a rural VA setting?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it could. I don't know exactly what it would look like at this point, but it is something that I want to look into exploring. So for veterans who get hospitalized outside of the VA, but they are returning through either CBOX or, telehealth, to see if we could see those veterans via telehealth or some other means. I certainly am interested in expanding and looking at that. I think it's a possibility, and as you all know, those veterans are likely at even further elevated risk, so it would certainly be warranted.
Thank you for that reply. In terms of suicides completed, in the past, research indicated that methods were rated as follows, with use of guns being the highest completed suicides and carbon monoxide being the lowest. So it went guns, jumping, pills, hanging, cutting, and carbon monoxide. Do you know if this is still accurate?
I don't know. I know firearms are certainly the most lethal. I think that's across across any population, but certainly with our veteran population, firearms are definitely the most lethal. In terms of the rest of the list, I would have to look. I'm not sure if that's still current, and also if that is the same for our veteran population. I don't know if you know anything further than that, Dr. Stecker.
I actually don't. I know that firearms and pills are high up there.
Thank you both. Are the therapists delivering any type of evidence-based curriculum, or do they just provide therapy? And if so, what are they delivering?
I don't know if that's for both programs or for Dr. Steckers.
Oh, if it was for me, could you please repeat it? I assumed that it was for you.
I think it could be for either. We could both answer, but...
No problem. Are the therapists delivering any type of evidence-based curriculum, or do they just provide therapy? And if so, what are they delivering?
Well, it's definitely not a question for me, I don't believe, because we are not administering any therapy. Ours is just a one-session cognitive behavioral discussion about the thoughts about getting help. So there's no therapy provided in my trial.
Yeah, and ours isn't therapy either. Ours is really, I refer to it as an intervention, but not therapy. So we're doing mostly assessment and sort of, bridging folks with care. That being said, all the components of it are evidence-informed. We use cognitive behavioral strategies and different aspects of suicide prevention that are evidence-informed, but it's not based in any one sort of therapy, as it's not a therapeutic intervention.
Thank you. I might have missed this, but what percentage of vets approached about the home visit program said yes to having the home visit?
100% of them did.
Wow.
Well, I'm sorry, 100% who enrolled in the program agreed to the home visit, and then I'd have to look it up to get the exact number, but it was between 85 and 90% of veterans that we approached about the clinical program enrolled in the program. So very few actually declined it. So from a sort of acceptability standpoint, the veterans are very interested in it.
Thank you. Do you activate protocols based simply on subject survey responses, for example, the PHQ-9 or the CSSR?
If that is for me, the answer is no. Everybody gets the assessment battery at all time points, baseline 1, 3, 6, and 12 months.
Thank you. Did you want to add to that at all, Bridget?
Sure. We are assessing risk in a variety of ways. So if it's our clinician during the clinical interview, they're, you know, obviously asking, or I'm sorry, during the clinical program, they're asking a lot of the questions assessing risk. That's more interview-based. And so they're assessing that way. And then we do include measures such as the Beck Scale for Suicidal Ideation and the Columbia, the CSSRS, in our measures. So that's another place where we could identify risk. But we don't have a cutoff per se or anything like that. It's really just based on kind of the things we talked about earlier with the safety protocol question.
Thank you both. The next question. I am a colonel in the United States Army Reserve and a commander of 118 soldiers. I would like to know if there are any plans to have the Alpha notes in the military and the VA CRPS and or VISTA interface with each other.
I love that question, Judge. I just suspect you're asking two people who are not in the loop to have the answers.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that there is certainly some movement towards better integration between the two systems, but the status of that, I definitely cannot speak to. I don't know where that's at.
Thank you. It's the ongoing conundrum of getting the DoD and the VA to work in conjunction. Okay, that is the final pending question. A lot of people wrote in saying thank you for the wonderful presentation. And at this point, I'd like to give either of you the opportunity to make any concluding comments in no particular order. Dr. Stecker, do you have anything you'd like to wrap up with?
I appreciate the opportunity to present this data today. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Matarazzo.
I appreciate the opportunity and just wanted to add that it seems like one of the themes that came up with the questions was just sort of doing research with high-risk populations and a lot of questions around the logistics of doing that. And the center that I work at, everything we do is with high-risk veterans, so we do a lot of research with this population. So if folks have follow-up questions about working with IRBs around this issue or safety protocols, that sort of a thing, feel free to shoot me an email or give me a call if you have further questions about that.
Excellent. Well, thank you both so much for joining us and lending your expertise to the field. And, of course, thank you for our attendees for joining us for this Suicide Prevention Cyber Seminar, which we hold one every month on the second Tuesday of the month at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'm sorry, that would be 3 p.m. Eastern. And I am going to close out the session in just a moment, so please wait while the feedback survey pops up on your screen and take just a moment to fill out those few short questions. We look very closely at your responses, and it helps us to improve the sessions we've already given, as well as gives us ideas for new sessions to support. So once again, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar. Thank you, Tracy. Thank you, Bridget.
Thank you.